Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that's Sandy Nelson with Let There Be Drums. What a great song. It's a great way to start the day, any time of the day, it's a great way to get started. All right, welcome to the show today. It's packed towards the end of the show. We're going to be talking with Dolores Canales, who's the mother of a man in Pelican Bay Shoe, and he's someone who's participating in the hunger strike. So we're going to listen to some updates about what's the latest updates about what's going on in the strike, and we'll also be talking to Dolores about what's it like? You know, what's it like? And she hasn't seen her son in quite some time. We'll talk about all that. He's been in the Pelican Bay Shoe. He's been in the Pelican Bay Shoe and another shoe before that for 10 years. All right. And before that, we'll be talking with Gail Dines, who's a professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College and the chair of American Studies at Wheelock College. And she's also the author of Pornland, How Pornography Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. And we're going to be talking with Gail about the Dominic Strauss-Kahn case and his rape of an African immigrant maid, okay? And how that's being brushed aside and prettified, and he's wandering around free to rape again. And opening this show up, I'm really happy to welcome back to the show Robert Perry. Bob is a journalist and an author. He broke many of the Iran-Contra stories in the 1980s for Associated Press and Newsweek. He currently writes at consortiumnews.org. And his latest book is Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. And that was written with two of his sons. And we're talking with Bob today about a recent piece he wrote called War and More War, The Continuing Influence That the Neocons Are Exerting Because of Their Control of the Key Media Like New York Times and Washington Post, the editorial control or editorial influence. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael.
Sure. Well, it's good to have you back, man. Always a provocative little – I see these provocative little pieces you get, and they grab me, and I got to get you on the show right away. So keep them coming.
By the way, Michael, it's consortiumnews.com.
Oh, consortiumnews.com. Okay, sorry about that. No wonder I couldn't find you. I get it right when I'm doing it. Yeah, right, exactly. Okay, that's great. I'll remember consortiumnews.com. And let's talk about this. Your piece – you issue a warning, more or less, that the neocon agenda is still very much in effect, and it's especially evident in the editorial influence that the neocons have in the Washington Post and the New York Times, as well as other papers, but particularly you center in on those two papers, and you describe them as two vintage ocean liners competing to become the flagship for American neoconservatism. You know, I think that even a lot of people that say, okay, you can't believe the press has an opinion that's pretty much straight up the government press, but even then, I think people don't see this sort of flagship for American neoconservatism. What gives here?
Well, the Washington Post has been moving in that direction for quite some time. I worked at the company when I was with Newsweek, the Post Newsweek company, and I could see it even then back in the late 80s, early 90s, that there was this growing tendency to favor the sort of Reagan-esque foreign policy, aggressive, going into various countries around the world, asserting American power, promoting essentially what became sort of the neocon agenda, particularly in the Middle East. And that continued and got deeper and stronger over the ensuing years. By the time you get to 2002 and 2003, the Washington Post is actively selling the Iraq War, most notably the day after Colin Powell gave his deceptive speech to the United Nations on February 5th, 2003, the next day, the Washington Post op-ed page was like a solid phalanx of fawning articles, and one also on the editorial page, praising the case that Colin Powell made and essentially saying there can be no doubt now about this because Colin Powell has said it, and it was just completely wrong. Even Colin Powell admits now that it was completely wrong. But that was sort of the tone, and it's remained that way. And even despite the failure of the Iraq War in many ways, the neocons have remained very powerful. There's been no real accountability for the Post getting that so things wrong so often. Fred Hyatt, who was executive page editor back then, is still the executive page editor. He still has the Charlie Krauthammers and that crowd filling up the editorial pages. And to a degree, we're seeing something similar happen in the New York Times, perhaps not as advanced. There's a bit more diversity in the Times editorial section, but Andy Rosenthal, who's the executive page or the editorial page editor there, is sort of doing the same thing. And we see this very much now with the pressure from both these two major papers, very influential papers, pushing for escalation in Libya, for instance. Both papers criticized President Obama for not being more aggressive in Libya, not sending in close combat support aircraft and really taking a role in fighting the civil war. They're obviously pushing for more aggressive policies against Iran and against Syria. In essence, they're continuing the neocon agenda that we came to know in the last decade, which was sort of to violently achieve regime change throughout the region in ways that were intended to both advance U.S. interests but also Israel's interests. And we've seen the consequences of that, but we have not seen any accountability for the bad reporting, the very misguided policies that those papers have pushed when it comes to the personnel running those newspapers.
We're talking with Bob Perry from ConsortiumNews.com, and we're talking about the influence, the continuing influence of the neocon agenda on the major media in this country. Now, Bob, one of the things that, as you're talking, you know, it's really interesting because I you made a point in your piece about the first casualty of war is truth. And, you know, that's a quote that gets thrown around a lot. But in particular, in relation to this, in relation to this reshaping of the Middle East, you know, you can see where facts have just been tossed out the window completely. You know, nothing irks me more than to read the things about Libya. And, you know, you're looking at what they're saying in Libya, and they're completely, there's a denial, not even an approach to the facts. There is no history. According to what they're doing, there's no history involved in what's going on between the U.S. and Libya today, or what's going on in Libya today. It's just like it started a couple months ago, and that was the beginning. There's no history about the, you know, the relationship between the U.S. and Libya since 2001. There's no history about the all the stuff that you know, comes up in that that could contradict what they're trying to do right now, you know, never appears. And if anything is spoken to, it's spoken to as lies.
Well, the real problem, Michael, is that a lot of it is false history that we get, or certainly, let's say, highly dubious history. One of the touchstones of that entire policy is the certainty, which you hear expressed across the board in the Washington press corps, that Libya carried out the Lockerbie bombing. Now, the actual evidence on that is extremely weak. I would say, you know, transparently weak. What happened with the case in 2001 when these two Libyans were put on trial by this rather strange Scottish court, and one of them was acquitted, one of them was found guilty. But the evidence against them was essentially non-existent. It was almost like they, and we now know, based on one of the comments made by one of the judges to a New York Times reporter, that an academic who passed it on to the New York Times, but that there was political pressure placed on the judges to get a conviction. And if you look at the evidence, and we did a piece at the time in 2001, which I worked with William Blum, the historian, on it, and basically, if you go through the ruling, what you see is the most unlikely set of circumstances that would have, which would have linked this individual with the bombing. Basically, the scheme would have had required this guy to have put a bomb in a suitcase, put it on a plane in Malta, have the plane fly to Frankfurt, where the bomb would then have to be unaccompanied, but sort of somehow transferred to a feeder flight to Pan Am 103A. Then flown to London, transferred again unaccompanied onto this Pan Am 103, and then blow up over Lockerbie, Scotland. And as Blum pointed out, and as the Scottish court acknowledges, every piece of luggage on those interim flights was accounted for. So you had this sort of, it was a totally bizarre thing where they essentially wanted to find somebody to blame because it was a horrible act of terrorism. And so they picked a Libyan, you know, this guy Megrahi. And even the Scottish Appeals Court was about to sort of, it would have taken this up as a gross miscarriage of justice in 2007. They were still thinking about it in 2009, possibly moving to acquit or to throw the case out when he contracted prostate cancer and was released on humanitarian grounds, which produced a great furor. But we see now not just the American political leaders asserting this as fact, but we see whether it's Andrea Mitchell on MSNBC or the New York Times in their daily coverage, this stated as flat fact. Now, one wants to say that go through sort of there's this, you know, suspicion or whatever you want to call it, but it's highly disputable. It's highly unlikely. And Blum, as he's written about it, says it's virtually impossible this guy did it. But still, you've got this sense of people believing a history, much like they believed WMD existed in usable forms in Iraq in 2002 and 2003. It's pushed. It's propaganda. It's not real. It's not what people think it is. And then the United States bases these basing their actions on these false premises, then goes off and fights wars. So you have this terribly serious problem where we just can't get the kind of objective, honest journalism that many of us had certainly, you know, when I was in the business and the mainstream media, I tried to provide it, but you run into all this headwind when you're going against the grain on some of these stampedes. And so you have this conventional wisdom that forms up, and it's extremely dangerous.
You know, one of the things, Bob, that got me too in your piece is you talk about the crumbling wall between opinion and news, and that seems to be a big part of what's going on today, where opinions are being presented as news and then propagated broadly and fought for in terms of this is the reality that we're dealing with, when actually it's a bunch of sandcastles getting hit by waves, you know? But they're still doing everything. They're implementing that agenda to reshape the Middle East with nothing but opinions, basically.
Right, and you are seeing it spilling over. For instance, relating to Iran and the election, that the Ahmadinejad election, it's clear from the serious studies that have been done that Ahmadinejad won that election. He won it because he had a lot of support from the religious conservative people, the sort of the working class kind of people in Iran, and he was and he prevailed. He was not very popular among some of the students, young people in Tehran, understandably so, in my opinion. But he won the election, and that's what these studies show. And that's what, you know, in terms of the various polls all showed it, both before and after the election. People were interviewed in various ways by different opinion research groups. But it became suitable in the New York Times and the Washington Post and the major newspapers to simply assert that he'd won it by rigging it or fraud. And it became this sort of, it was always said. And it really wasn't true, but it became part of the way it was all presented. And those kinds of examples of really sloppy or biased reporting have consequences. You know, having been in those kinds of jobs, I understand how a journalist feels. It is safe for you to go with the flow. It is safe career-wise to go with the flow. It is dangerous career-wise to go against the flow. And if you do it too many times, you're likely not to be promoted, or maybe you're going to lose your job, or you'll get a lousy assignment. Those kinds of things happen to people. So I understand exactly why people do this, but they're not serving their readers. They're not serving the public by presenting these biased versions of what's happening in the world. It only allows then unscrupulous politicians and policymakers to implement very dangerous actions. And we had obviously the worst example was probably Iraq, but you can see that kind of thing replicated at various levels repeatedly now around the world. And the American press corps has lost its way. You know, maybe some would argue that it never had its way, but certainly if you go back to the 1970s when we had more independence, more willingness to go against the grain, whether it be Watergate or whether it be the Pentagon Papers, you know, you go through those kinds of stories, you would see a tendency to be more independent. But since the 80s and this more concentrated assault that the right wing organized against the Washington Press Corps, you have seen the Washington Press Corps in the mainstream broken down and becoming essentially a threat to the public rather than any asset to the public. And, you know, I could go on I give you a dozen examples of this, but believe me, that's what happened.
We're talking with Bob Perry from ConsortiumNews.com, and he's a journalist and author, writes regularly at ConsortiumNews.com. Bob, you know, one of the things I was going to ask you is I've been particularly, you know, following Libya, and I was thinking, you know, knowing all along the stuff that you had talked about the Lockerbie thing and what that, and the problems that developed with that in terms of the person that they had accused of doing it and all this. And even after 9/11, 2001, things changed with Libya. Gaddafi went and opened up to the U.S. The U.S. went and opened up to Gaddafi. But we don't see any of the news about that. I mean, even the fact that Hillary Clinton, just a short time before Gaddafi was revealed as a monster in the U.S. press, Hillary Clinton was eating dinner with him, you know, and his sons were around, were feeded around the world, you know, and he was not the pariah that he had been 20, 30 years before that. He was someone that they were actually able to work with. But no one anywhere, I haven't seen anyone anywhere in the mainstream press say, look, all this that happened, this is what changed the scene now. We've stopped being friends with him now. Now he's the arch enemy of the world, you know. Have you seen anywhere where they've taken up that kind of, you know, correction, say? And, you know, I've rarely seen any of the major newspapers or media back up and say, we made a huge mistake here. We got to tell you we made a huge mistake. If they did that, they would probably have trouble being considered the newspaper of the record.
Well, I think what you've seen, and we can go back again through many, many examples, is this sort of turning on, turning off, whether someone is a wonderful ally or an evil monster. You can go to Manuel Noriega in Panama, who was extremely helpful. When I was doing the Iran-Contra work, even before it was Iran-Contra down in Central America, Noriega was a guy who was helping out the Contras. He had meetings with Vice President Bush and Ollie North and Bill Casey. He was a guy that could be counted on to deliver, and he sent money and provided other assistance to the Contras, so he was one of our guys. And then things got a lot of hand too much. There was too much heat about his drug involvement, which wasn't a big problem before, but suddenly became one, and then politics switched, and we had to invade Panama, kill a bunch of people to arrest him. And then you had the same situation with Saddam Hussein, who was an ally during the 1980s when the U.S. was going back and forth between trying to balance Iran and Iraq during their war, helping Iran, helping Iraq, you know, playing these games. But then later on, when things got sort of out of control, when he invaded Kuwait, he's suddenly a monster. So we go back and forth on these things. And obviously Gaddafi is a good example, too, of him being an exaggerated monster at one point. And then he becomes this, he gets sort of cleaned up, and he's even sort of a reformer of some sort, because he's agreed to sort of help again the war on terror. And then he's a monster again. So it's a very odd thing. It reminds one of 1984 and Orwell's observations about this sort of constantly changing of who our friends are, who our enemies are, and how they never were our friends or never were our enemies before that. And then you have to have sort of certain troublesome reporters kind of reminding you of these things, but frankly, it doesn't happen much. But basically, in the case of Gaddafi, the press's role has always been to sort of take the very harshest view of Gaddafi. He was the monster back in the 70s, the most dangerous man in the world. Then he never really got cleaned up as far as many of the people in the press were concerned. He was always considered basically a monster. He was blamed for Lockerbie, even though there really isn't any evidence of that. And then he got cleaned up a little bit, but the press was always a little bit uneasy with that. And then it was much more comfortable making him a monster again. But these are almost propaganda. These are caricatures of people. Gaddafi certainly is an unstable guy, and anyone who watched his speech at the UN a couple of years ago would say he's a megalomaniac of some sort. And he certainly has been involved in some very dirty things over the years. But he has other attributes as well, in terms of how he's tried to use the money of the country to build it up. And he certainly has not been as, in that sense, he certainly is no worse than, let's say, many of our great friends in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and elsewhere. So you end up with this sort of sliding scale of how someone's considered, not based on some objective, even-handed approach, but really based on, is he in favor, is the U.S. government favoring him now, are the people in, so the influential people of Washington favoring this guy, or are they not? And the press just kind of moves back and forth, more or less, with that change of feeling.
Well, we have one more question, Bob, and that is, going back to this point you made about Orwell and the point that we started to talk to earlier about the old saying that the first casualty of war is truth, you raise in your piece that what happens if you have perpetual war? And that's a big question. What happens if you have a war on the world, if you have this idea that, you know, that they're out to reshape the Middle East in a way that best serves the U.S. and Israel, and everything gets twisted and fashioned to work on that, to push that? What happens to truth in a situation where you have a perpetual war?
Well, the point of the piece was to say that truth is then lost completely, and lost rather permanently, because the people that run the government and the people that, in a sense, are influential at the highest levels of news media see their role as manipulating the public. When I was at Newsweek, I was once told that I was arguing for just sort of laying out facts. I'd come out of the Associated Press and more of a sort of working man's kind of news outfit, you know, facts man, just the facts. And I got to Newsweek, and there was this attitude of, well, we don't really want to just lay out this. We want to sort of guide people. We want to guide the public in a certain direction. We think these are the wise policies. In the case of Newsweek, they felt that they actually were very supportive of the Reagan foreign policy, the more aggressive, get out there and kick the commies around in Central America, et cetera. They were in favor of that. So there was this, so they wanted to guide the public in those directions. And I think when you get to those, that stratospheric level of the news media and of government, that's the way they look at it. It's not what's the truth, let's present it honestly and fairly and even-handedly. It becomes, how can we spin this, how can we shape that, and how ultimately can we sort of manufacture consent, one of the famous Chomsky lines. But so that, I think that is how it's looked at. Everything becomes agitprop. And if war is perpetual, there won't be any time really to sort of recover even between the wars, because the war will go on forever. We'll constantly have to have these evolving enemies. And I think it's very dangerous, certainly for a democracy, if that's what we still have in this country. It's certainly very dangerous for the idea of an informed electorate if this is how the game gets played.
All right, Bob, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael.
And I'll have you back again soon, man. Take care.
Okay.
Bye now. All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Bob Perry from ConsortiumNews.com about what happens in a world that's perpetually at war. And basically, the answer is truth is lost, perhaps forever, okay, at least if you're stuck in the confines of the way this system operates. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Gail Dines, a professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College and chair of the American Studies there, and she's also got a piece that was just recently written in Counterpunch, published in Counterpunch, and it's about Dominique Strauss-Kahn and the meaning of consent. So stay tuned. Welcome back, and that's Body from Tao Wen, and her album is No Better, Learn Faster. Really remarkable singer, really remarkable musician. And I thought this was a perfect song to bring in our next guest, Gail Dines. Gail is a professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College and chair of the American Studies. She's also the author of Pornland, How Pornography Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. Out-sexuality. And people, you're going to have to excuse me today. I've had dental work done, and I seem to be losing my ability to move my jaw up and down. So I'll have to let Gail do most of the talking this time. Gail, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, I've been better. Well, this piece is really a remarkable piece, I thought, in a swamp of just terrible things that have been said about this situation, which is a few months ago, a young African immigrant, a maid at a major hotel in New York City, says that she was attacked and raped by Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the head of the International Monetary Fund. After an initial outburst and holding him in jail and all this other stuff, suddenly the tables have been reversed and he's the victim, and this African immigrant maid is the terrible, terrible, you know, monster who brought mm-hmm. a hammer down on his head. You say that this case basically belongs in a world of porn. What do you mean?
Well, let me say, I wrote this article for Counterpunch literally at 2 a.m. when I was in such a rage, as I'm sure many women are, about this whole case. It's like, here we see, you know, a serial predator who has a history of abuse, you know, history after history, and yet they have turned the spotlight on her, turned her into, you know, a liar, a slut, a whore, all of these things. And I was lying in bed thinking, you know, this is so outrageous, and how is it possible that, you know, there is forensic evidence that sex took place, and that they're spinning it as consensual, that here is a poor woman who is, you know, supporting herself and her child, who goes to work in low-paid, low-skilled work in a hotel. And, you know, what happens? She walks into the hotel room and is overcome by lust, by a man who's old enough to be her father, and she can't help herself but have, you know, great sex with him. And what kind of world does that belong in? And that really belongs in the world of pornography. And as I talk about in my article, and also in my book, Pornland, you know, there's a very popular website called Maid Bangers, which is exactly the story, where you have men who roam the hotels looking for women who are maids, and they have great, wonderful sex, and these women are just, you know, really happy to have sex. Because, you know, in pornography, women don't go to work for wages or dignity or for livelihood. They go to work because this is a place to have, you know, great sex. It's a world devoid of the reality of women's lives. You know, in pornography, women don't need health care, they don't need safe housing, they don't need good jobs, they don't need any of those things. They just need, you know, lots and lots of men and lots of penises and lots of semen. And I think this is why we can spin this ridiculous story, because we live in a society infused with the pornographic mentality. And I'm telling you, if it didn't, then they would not be able to spin the story as they have, because it would be so utterly ridiculous that nobody, no lawyer, would dare suggest in any way that it was consensual.
Well, you know, Gail, one of the things that you mentioned I thought was really important is you also referred to, look, there's a whole spate of these things. It seems that there's a whole spate of, you know, very powerful, wealthy men who decide at some point that they have, or they get caught. They don't just decide, they get caught in this kind of behavior, this kind of reprehensible, horrible behavior, this total dehumanization of women. And you argue, you say that there must be something that gives these men permission to act this way. What do you think it is?
Well, of course, what I think it is, it's patriarchy, which gives them, you know, male power. Because, you know, I'm sure we don't have Hillary Clinton behaving like Anthony Weiner. I'm sure we don't have pictures of Madeleine Albright, you know, circulating where she was sending pictures of herself naked, you know, whatever, to younger men. This is men in specific positions of power. But let me say, you know, I think many men, whether they've got power or not, would like to behave like this. But once they're in positions of power, then they feel kind of permission from the society to behave and to get away with it. And I want to say something very important about Dominic Strauss-Kahn. Remember, he was head of the IMF. The job of the IMF, one would hope on some level, although it's probably a bit of a joke, is to kind of take care of a lot of people in developing countries and countries, you know, which have been in the past colonized by the West, which are struggling to kind of make their way financially. And here you have a man who doesn't see women as human beings. He sees women, you know, as potential sex objects, as women to rape, women to sexually harass. And so my question would be, you know, we should start looking at all of the policies that have been happened under Strauss-Kahn, because my sense is a man like this has not made policies which in any way are favorable to women and their children.
Well, you know, you think about it, and actually the case here of this African immigrant maid, and, you know, basically you look at what the IMF has done, and you can't help in the third world in particular, you look at that, and what has it done? What has it done in relation to, you know, the question of there's racism, there's the conditions that women face in these third world countries that really do. I mean, that plays into this whole thing about in terms of giving permission. They could easily say this is just the world, the way the world is set up. We're just like that, you know.
And I think this is what we need to really start talking about. Is that, you know, we talk about women's poverty and we talk about, you know, issues of child poverty, which of course is related to the fact that their mothers are in poverty. But, you know, the fact that we need to link that to the idea that men are in positions of power and men are making policies about women's lives. They're making policies which decide how women live and die. And my fear is that the more our culture becomes more pornographic, the less likely these men are going to be able to make any policies that allow women and their children to live with any dignity. This is what I said in an article I was interviewed for about Anthony Weiner. And I said, you know, here's a man who's meant, you know, again as a joke, to represent, you know, 51% of the population, you know, women. And a woman approaches him, and what does he see? He sees an opportunity to send a picture of himself, you know, an explicit picture of himself. And this is a man whose job it was also to represent women. And I think, as we know, the IMF and all of these major organizations that have done horrible things to, you know, all countries all across the globe, is to look at the men who are running this and to understand the way in which they perceive women, they perceive the importance of women's lives, and always, of course, children's lives.
Well, you know, one of the things that actually happened, and I think it's tied into that, is no sooner had this been reported and there was an initial, you know, fury about, well, this rich guy and this rich white guy, and what did he do, this African immigrant, although many people didn't even know that this was an African immigrant, that the woman who was raped was an African immigrant. But when that came out, there was this whole thing that developed. One, she became the victimizer. You know, and you spoke to that earlier, but I mean, there was a whole way that this came out of she, you know, suddenly every time she burped wrong in the world was reported, and she became the evil victimizer in this story, which is really just repellent.
Well, you know what? We could have written this. I mean, we have examples. The woman, oh, happened at Duke, Anita Hill, which I say in my article. You know, the Anita Hill case, again, another woman of color who was hung out to dry. And what was amazing about the Anita Hill case, and why I really do focus on this, is here was a squeaky clean, right-wing, conservative woman who had hitched her wagons basically to the Republican establishment. Now, even if they could turn her into a, as they said, a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty, which is the term that David Brock invented to define her, if they could turn her into kind of a victimizing whore out to get poor Clarence Thomas, then let me tell you, no woman is safe. And this is what happens when women bring cases, and not just against powerful men, because I want to make this clear, that I've had students who've been raped by, you know, guys in college, and they do exactly the same thing. They go for the throat of the woman who has been victimized, and they turn her into the victim, into the victimizer. And I really do think it's part of the culture we live in, that they do not see rape as a real crime, that rape is, as I've often heard, he said, she said, as if, you know, a woman would come forward and from nowhere pull out a rape case. Why would a woman do such a thing? And we know that, you know, there's very few cases of falsely accused rape. There are statistics on this, and there are very few, you know, cases. And yet, of course, we could have written the script that they were going to turn her into this lying whore.
We're talking with Gail Dines, a professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College and a chair of American Studies there. She's also the author of Pornland, How Pornography Has Hijacked Out Sexuality. Now, Gail, one question here. You also bring up in your article in Counterpunch this idea that that the press has been running with of there's sex offender hysteria. Can you talk about that, what that is?
Well, I don't know what such a thing is. I heard this on NPR for the first time, and I'm thinking, what is this? And then, again, you know, what they're saying here is that somehow we all jump on this bandwagon, we're all quick to basically rush to judgment that these guys are guilty. And I have to say, you know, when you have other cases of people who've transgressed the law, very, very rarely do we talk about this rush to judgment. I only ever hear this term when it is usually a powerless woman who is accusing a powerful man. And this is why the term, it has been termed kind of sex offender hysteria, which I actually don't know what that is, because what that seems to me is just a way to excuse the behavior of men. And I want to say something that's interesting, that the story before me was on this war, the idea of perpetual war. You know, and as I'm listening to this, I'm thinking, you know, there has been a perpetual war declared on women. There are no front lines to this war. There's never been a ceasefire on the war against women. We have no treaties. We never know when it's going to stop, and it has been going on for God knows how long. And so I think women need to begin to see themselves as literally in a state of siege, in a state of war. The level of violence against women and children continue to increase. The society, the legal system refuses to take it seriously, and women have to live with the consequences of this. And why I wrote my book and why I do what I do is hope that women get more political. And I think, you know, we should get politicized around Strauss-Kahn. I want to see women enraged. I want to see women organizing. And I want to see them shouting out for women who have been victimized and who themselves don't have a voice.
You know, I was going to move right to that next point, which I think is really important. And you've made a statement once that you said women should be fighting for liberation from culturally imposed myths about their sexuality that encourage gendered violence. Our daughters and our sons have the right to live in a world that celebrates equally women's sexual freedom and bodily integrity. Let's close out on that. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm saying that, again, because we're living in a society, and, you know, I keep talking about pornography, and I think many of your listeners are probably thinking, you know, why is she talking about pornography? What's the big deal? Some pictures of Playboy or Penthouse? And what I want to sort of say to your listeners is, first of all, the reason I talk about pornography is that the average age of looking at pornography today is around 11 or 12 for boys. They do not look at Playboy or Penthouse. They look at what's called gonzo pornography, which is cruel, debasing, dehumanizing, violent. And we are now bringing up a generation of boys on hardcore pornography who have constant access via the internet. And we have never done this before. We are in the midst of a mass social experiment. And one of the concerns that I have is that when these boys develop and grow up and become men, they're all going to be little Dominique Strauss-Kahns. Dominique Strauss-Kahn is going to become the norm if we continue to bring men up on violent pornography.
Well said, Gail. And thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Okay, take care now.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we were just talking with Gail Dines, who's a professor of sociology and women's studies and the chair of American Studies at Wheelock College. She is also the author of Pornland, How Pornography Has Hijacked Out Sexuality. And now it's time for your basics. We want to get into the basics a little bit. So you can't change the world without knowing the basics. And this is from Bob Avakian's new book, Basics. And I think it's very fitting and important to consider this now after this discussion. Look at all these beautiful children who are female in the world. And in addition to all the other outrages which I have referred to in terms of children throughout the slums and shantytowns of the third world, in addition to all the horrors that will be heaped on them, the actual living in garbage and human waste in the hundreds of millions as their fate laid out before them, yes, even before they are born, there is, on top of this, for those children who are born female, the horror of everything that this will bring simply because they are female in a world of male domination. And this is true not only in the third world, in modern countries like the U.S. as well. The statistics barely capture it. The millions who will be raped, the millions more who will be routinely demeaned, deceived, degraded, and all too often brutalized by those who are supposed to be their most intimate lovers. The way in which so many women will be shamed, hounded, and harassed if they seek to exercise reproductive rights through abortion or even birth control. The many who will be forced into prostitution and pornography, and all those who, if they do not have that particular fate, and even if they achieve some success in this new world, where supposedly there are no barriers for women, will be surrounded on every side and insulted at every moment by a society and a culture which degrades women on the streets, in the schools and workplaces, in the home, on a daily basis and in countless ways. That's from Bob Avakian, and the book is Basics. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Dolores Canales to talk about what's going on at Pelican Bay and the story of her son who's in the Pelican Bay shoe and taking part in the hunger strike. So stay tuned. Alright, listen to me. That's Baby Huey from the Baby Huey Story, The Living Legend, an incredible album, incredible singer. He's unfortunately died a long time ago, but his music is there for us all the time. Make sure you pick that one up. It's really a remarkable set. Joining us now is Dolores Canales, who's a mother of a son who's locked up in the Pelican Bay shoe, and she's here to talk with us about her son's story. Dolores, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, let's talk about you. I basically found out about your story through someone who met you at an action involving or around the Pelican Bay hunger strike. Now, your son is in Pelican Bay in the security housing unit, the SHU, now, right?
Yes, he is. He's in the SHU. He was transferred there from Corcoran in March, and he's been now turned over to the short row, as they call it, the short row overflow.
Now, was he in the Corcoran SHU as well?
Yes, he was in the Corcoran SHU. He's been in there since 2001.
So he's been in the SHU unit one place or another for 10 years.
Yes, wow. That's correct.
How did he end up in the SHU unit?
Well, I know he was, they have these men in prison. It's called the Men's Advisory Council, and they have one, a representative from each ethnicity, and he was a Hispanic advisory council on the MAC, as they call it. He was a Hispanic member, and he was on the yard at Corcoran, and he's a self-proclaimed jailhouse lawyer. He's taken some courses in paralegal studies. He's received diplomas in civil litigation, and he is very actively involved in helping he will help somebody do their writ to get them back into court or to file medical 602s and grievances within the prison system and the process that they have. And so he was a MAC representative on the yard of Corcoran, and then he was put in SHU because he had confidential statements against him alleging that he was with a gang. And so these confidential statements, other inmates can make a statement, and then they use that to get the individual and lock them up, and as they call it, indefinitely, in an indeterminate SHU term. And in my sense, right now with his SHU term, as with many of the men in there, they have these statements against them by other inmates, and actually no evidence to corroborate these statements. There does not need to be any actual evidence to corroborate these statements. And one thing that they don't even have a 115 now. 115 is when there's a serious rule violation. They write you up, and it's documented and considered as a 115, a serious rule violation. They're not even given 115. So there's not even documentation of a serious rule violation other than the confidential informant statements that are being used against them. But then they do say, you know, I've heard the comments from CDCR saying these men have the right to get out. All they have to do is not be in contact with anyone that we think is a gang member for 6 years. But they're using things, something as simple as a drawing, a greeting card. They'll use something like that to further their SHU term. They'll say, oh, you have a drawing, and, you know, something. And actually, drawings, artistic creation drawings, addresses, and greeting cards are all allowed per Title 15 CCR 3378. So it's in their rules that this is all allowable. But then what they use it as, what the CDCR turns around and does with it, is they use it to say that this is part of a gang act. And so it's just kind of, it's like a never-ending once you get in the SHU. Most of the men that do get out of the SHU, it's only because they've chosen to debrief. And by debriefing, that means now you're taking it upon yourself to make a statement against another inmate. And they don't have to prove if it's true. And then you get put on a special needs yard if you've chosen to debrief. And which is one thing I would like to mention about the special needs yard, because I've heard so much public outcry, which I understand, believe me, my heart goes out to anyone that has been a victim of, of a crime at all, let alone a violent crime, and a lost a loved one. I'm in no way trying to condone or pacify, you know, illegal behavior or illegal activity. But a lot of times in these situations, people are crying out about the child killers and the pedophiles and the rapists. And what I feel society needs to know is per department, California Department of Corrections, they're put on a special needs yard where they're protected. And where they're housed at, they're able to have outdoor activities. They're able to have contact visits. They're able to have spend like $180 a month in the store and get a goodie box every 3 months. That is where the pedophiles and the rapists and the child molesters are housed, on the special needs yard. The SHU is totally different from the special needs yard. So when society keeps labeling these men as those types of offenses, it's totally different. And CDC can verify this fact about the special needs yard. I mean, it's something that can be verified. And so, I do know there's a lot of outrage, and I've even read comments that there's absolutely no way in the world that these men are in SHU for no reason, that they had to have committed a violent act against an officer, or they've had to commit a violent act against another inmate, otherwise they would not be in there. This is exactly the point. This is exactly why they are on their 15th day with no food. This is exactly why they are willing to starve themselves to death. Because this is the message that people need to know and to hear. They are back there without, I'm not speaking for all, I can't, but for a lot of them, they are back there with absolutely no documentation of any kind of violence or assault against a staff, another inmate, or anyone for that matter. With anything, it's just the confidential informant statements that are being used and what they've started with this process. And that is their, that is, one of their issues. Another one of their issues is about abolishing mass punishment, we can make flight plans and travel plans and show up at Pelican Bay and get turned away that same morning if somebody in the same ethnicity group did something wrong. They say, oh, that whole group is locked down and they can't have visits. They don't even have to be on the same yard. And you get turned away. And, of course, you know, there's no reimbursement of finances or any prior warning or anything. It just, like, happens at a moment's notice. And the families are being punished as well. And I've been taught, a lot of family members have been contacting me. I have loved ones all over. I mean, I'm getting phone calls from parents from Calipatria, from wives from Folsom, from Donovan, and they're saying that, you know, my husband is participating in the hunger strike. My son is in Corcoran and he's participating in the hunger strike. They are telling me my loved ones are participating in the hunger strike and even writing goodbye notes in case they don't make it. And the news has not put this out there at all. It's nowhere being portrayed in the media, and it's just acting like it's going to go away. But the thing is it's not going to go away, and people are very concerned, and family members are getting sick. And, you know, because we want to know, we want to hear from Sacramento. If you can make a public statement to us, you know, what is going to go on? I mean, I literally called the other day, and I called Matthew Cate's office, and I couldn't even talk. I just broke down crying and I just said, just tell me, please just tell me so I could start trying to accept the fact. I need to hear it with my own ears. Are you going to just let these men die and not look at any of their issues, which the issues that are bringing up are valid according to law? You know, one issue that I found just in my own investigation since all this happened, the men didn't even bring this up, but on page 57 of the American Correctional Association, it has standards that prohibit most punishing physical conditions and segregation. Cells and accredited facilities must have windows. This is standard 4-4148, page 57. The SHU in Pelican Bay does not have any windows. My question now comes to mind is, if this is the American Correctional Association standard, this was written into practice and procedure, how did they get away with building the building of soundproof rooms with no windows and housing the people there for 10, 20, 30 years at a time? Who okayed it? Who okayed the building to be built? I mean, this is going way deeper than I ever even imagined, because when I called the governor's office, a spokesperson, of course the governor did not talk, a spokesperson insisted to me that Pelican Bay SHU units have windows. And it was just like, they insisted they have windows because it's against the law not to. So, you know, I feel like I'm just circling the wagon sometimes. Well,
let me ask you this, Dolores. First, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dolores Canales, whose son is one of the prisoners on the hunger strike at Pelican Bay, at the Pelican Bay SHU, the Pelican Bay Security Housing Unit. Now, Dolores, how old was your son when he went to jail?
My son was 18. He got arrested a week after he was 18, and he's 35 now.
And how long has it been since you've seen your son?
I myself have not seen my son since he was 18, since I went over for his birthday and took him a birthday cake and balloons, and then he got arrested right after that. And I did get to, that was the last time I saw him out here, and then I did get to see him in the county while he was going through this process, and then since he's been to prison, I have not been able to see him. I try not to speak too much about myself because I don't want to get off focus, but I myself do have a record. I have not been in any kind of trouble in over 10 years. I am a voter, a taxpayer. I have a passport to travel to other countries. I'm a productive member of society. I cannot get approved. I keep getting denied. At one point, I even drove my visiting application up to Corcoran because I had mailed it in, certified mail, and even after they verified that they received it, it disappeared. My whole visiting form with all my letters of reference and everything completely disappeared. To where then I drove it up, and, you know, they told me they needed, like, one more documentation, and I would take that, and then one more thing, and I was driving it from Orange County, because now at this point I did not feel safe to mail it, and I was placing it straight into the sergeant's hand, which he was being very grateful in accepting it from me, but I still was denied because of my past. And I have one now again pending. I have not given up. I have one pending. I have numerous letters of reference. I volunteer with at-risk youth using my past to hope that it would just help some of these kids to take a different way and to, you know, to realize the consequences. You know, when my son got arrested, he was in, you know, they were all just kind of like hanging out together, and they decided to go over somewhere else, and a fight broke out, you know, and they did end up convicting all eight of them that went that day, and it's just the laws. And now we're going into a whole different subject of just how, you know, the laws.
Right, which is, you know, they really do. I mean, there is a whole effort here, this mass incarceration, the U.S. prison population has quadrupled since 1980, and a lot of it involves the kind of assault against black people in America and Latino people in America. You know, the idea that these are unwanted people to a very large degree by the system, and they're going to corral them into these prisons. And that's, the prisons are just, you know, rapidly expanding, and there's cries for even more prisons from the people that run this country. And that speaks to exactly what you're saying. Now, I'd like to know, have you heard anything about your son since the strike began?
I did. The last I heard from him on the 5th, he still had not seen anybody. Medical had not weighed them, although I have heard from somebody else, another family member, that medical weighed them on the 7th. I have not heard. He got a visit a week before this started, and he has not, you know, I haven't heard from him. The last postcard I got, you know, he was just talking about, you know, he feels that their most important, what they want to put across is this is a, you know, a nonviolent demonstration, but it's one that they are the ones being hurt through this, in, you know, going without food, because it's just so important that people realize the conditions. And, you know, that was, let me see, yeah, that was, I think, on Monday is when I got that card. Now, these last few days, I have not heard anything, and I've been writing. I've been mailing, like, you know, 5-10 cards a day, just trying to let him know and to keep him, you know, motivated. And I'm talking to a lot of family members, and I mean, I'm tormented over this. I don't want him to go without food. You know, I don't. I'm not for this, but I guess I understand that they're just, you know, desperate to.
Well, when they've robbed you of your humanity, you know, there's a choice you have to make. It's, you know, a lot of these guys have said that living in the SHU unit is being given a civil death sentence, basically. You're locked away.
It's worse than a death sentence, right. Even. And, you know, one thing I do want to mention, though, too, when you said about the you know, the blacks and the Hispanics, and this is very true, but the way that they use this, they use it just as much against white people. There is a lot of white guys, you know, that believe that are just because they got a letter from somebody or because they got a card from somebody. I knew a girl that was actually arrested and put into SHU because she had a letter from a guy, and she was white, and they said, you're with us. So when it comes to this process that they do, it's affecting all races. This process that they have going on in the SHU, it does not discriminate.
It's actually shown in the unity between all the nationalities around this hunger strike. Dolores, we have to stop now, and I have a couple things to update with, but I want to thank you very much for joining us on the show today. And let's stay in touch, okay?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care now. Sure. And before we go out, I just want to give you folks a little bit of an update on the current situation with the Pelican Bay hunger strikers. All right. So on Friday, July 15th, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation announced that it was going to begin negotiations with the prisoners. Shortly after those negotiations began, however, it became clear that the CDCR, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, was not going to meet any of the strikers' demands. And in fact, they weren't even going to consider them seriously. Since that time, many of the prisoners have gotten very, very ill. Some of them report not even being able to urinate as a result of their 3 weeks of hunger strike. Remember, this is the third week of that hunger strike, and many of the prisoners are really, really ill. And it's really imperative for all of us to rise up and stand with them. Look at what these prisoners are doing in the place where you're not even supposed to be able, they're not even allowed to see the light of day. They've never seen a sunrise or a sunset in all the time that they've been in there. They've rarely seen a human face in all the time that they've been in there. But in a situation that would seem utterly hopeless, these prisoners are carrying on a fight for human dignity, basic human dignity. They're standing up and demanding, saying loud and clear that we are human beings and we demand to be treated as such. That's what their demands are all about. That's what the strike is all about. Prisoners demanding to be treated as human beings, something this system can't do for anyone of the people it oppresses, and especially not for the people it throws into its torture chambers and dungeons, all right? All right, this brings us to the close of another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Robert Perry from ConsortiumNews.com and Gail Dines, who's the author of Pornland, How Pornography Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. And I want to give a special thanks to Dolores Canales. Dolores is the mother of a man in the Pelican Bay Security Housing Unit, and her son is also a participant in the hunger strike in the Pelican Bay SHU and throughout a number of SHUs in the California State Prison System. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I want to thank my production assistant, Henry Carson, and my interns, Natalie Martinez and Hannah Malthrop. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in today and every week that you tune in. I want to thank you for listening. And you know, if you listen to this show, you know we're about one thing. And that is, we want to know the world so we can change the world. Why? Because we believe that there's a whole other way that we should be and could be living, but it's up to us to do something to get us there. And I want to extend an invitation to everyone who's listening to the show today. If you want to write to me with your suggestions, your comments, your criticisms, your ideas, please do. You can write to me at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, we're going to go out now with a song I want to dedicate to the Pelican Bay SHU hunger strikers, all right? And this is a piece by Aaron Neville, and it's called Angola Bound. So enjoy.
Too many mornings, gotta wake up soon. Oh, Lord, I need my breakfast by the light of the moon. Oh, Lord, by the light of the moon. If you see my mama, tell her this for me. Oh, I've got a mighty long time. Lord knows I'll never go free. Oh, Lord, I'll never be free.
Angola bound now. Angola bound. Angola bound.
I got lucky last summer when I got my time.
Angola bound.
Well, my ball, they got 100, I got 99.
Angola bound.
You've been a long time coming, but you're welcome home.
Angola bound.
Angola, Louisiana, get your burdens on.
Angola bound.
Oh, Captain, don't you be so cruel.
Angola bound.
Oh, you work me harder than you work that new.
Angola bound.
If it wasn't for the captain, oh Lord, I'm shaking house. I'd be with my woman, yeah, before the sun goes down. You come up here skipping and jumping, oh Lord, it won't last long. Gonna wish it was a baby boy and then mother alone.
Angola bound now. Angola bound.
Shaggy house, I'd be with my woman.